From KUOW, this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman.
I am very pleased to announce a tentative labor agreement that has been reached between the railroad workers and the railway companies. This agreement is a big win for America and for both, in my view.
That was President Joe Biden celebrating a tentative agreement to keep 120,000 rail workers on the job last week. It looked as though, until that agreement was announced, the U.S. rail industry was headed for a strike. That is until Biden and his labor secretary, Marty Walsh, managed to broker that deal just 24 hours before a shutdown of most rail service throughout the United States. Likely causing passenger delays and supply chain bottlenecks. Unions and their workers have a vote this Thursday on whether to accept the current agreement, push negotiations out, or get ready for another potential strike. This dispute over rail working conditions is several years in the making. So to tell us more, I spoke with Jonah Furman. Jonah is a writer with Labor Notes and is the author of Who Gets the Bird on Substack. And he told me that since the pandemic began, rail workers are expected to do more with less.
And when they say less, they mean drastically cutting the workforce. On some studies I've seen say that the workforce in the past 6 years alone has gone down by about 30%. Meanwhile, in the pandemic, they're moving more freight than they were before. So you have the amount of work going up and the amount of workers going down, which obviously squeezes the remaining workers in terms of particularly their time on the job. So to make this system work with, you know, using fewer workers to move more freight on the rails, the companies have gone even further in the direction of harsh scheduling policies where you're basically on call all the time. You have to be ready at any point to go into work. You have very few days off. And one of the things that rose to prominence in the negotiations over the past couple of weeks in particular was these workers get no sick days. It's sort of emblematic of how their personal lives are treated as rail workers. But in particular, you know, during the pandemic, you would have workers who would go out sick for COVID or other related things and get docked on their attendance, get fired, get disciplined. On top of that, you just have people's personal lives just decimated by the fact that they have to be ready to go into work at any moment. I talked to one worker who talked about how he, for the first 10 years on the job, he missed all of his daughter's softball games. And then the next 10 years on the job, he missed all of his grandson's softball games. So you just have generations of workers being tied to this job, working long hours and basically have no time off. What was sort of highlighted in the negotiations was workers got offered the biggest pay increase that they've percentage-wise in 40 years, which was, you know, welcome from the workers, but was really not the core issue for a lot of the workers who were holding out for some sort of redress of how their personal lives, their work-life balance, their time off, their sick time is treated.
Yeah, and that was part of this tentative agreement that was reached and announced on Thursday. Can you talk to me what was in that deal?
Yeah, so to understand this, in August, basically under how the rail workers are covered under federal labor law is when it gets to a certain point of impasse, the federal government plays a much larger role in rail negotiations than in other parts of the private sector. So in August, there was a presidential emergency board convened because the unions and the rail carriers couldn't come to a deal. So this board put together basically a suggested, here's what the deal should look like. And in that deal, that's where they proposed big raises, but didn't do anything about the time off issues. And that was the basis on which we got to this showdown last week, where basically that deal was not sufficient for the union leadership or for members of unions that voted. There was two unions that membership or lower level leaders voted it down. And the improvements on that deal were what Marty Walsh brokered. So they were working off of this presidential emergency board. You'll see this acronym PEB, the PEB recommendation. That's what they were working off of that was insufficient for a lot of these rail unions. So Marty Walsh and Joe Biden and other officials stepped in and did this marathon session of saying, okay, how can we improve upon the PEB, the board recommendation, something that the workers the unions can send back to the workers to vote on and see if they can live with it. And what they came to is actually still unknown. So this deal was announced at 5 a.m. on Thursday, but we haven't seen what the actual details, what the language is of a proposed contract. But the two big things that everyone agrees were in there were some amount of unpaid sick time. So the unions were calling for 15 paid sick days to be added. And the deal calls for some number, unspecified number, of some kind of unpaid sick time, basically saying you can now go to the doctor for certain things and not get penalized or risk your job, which was, you know, a big issue. The other thing was, and this has been covered less, was a cap on healthcare contributions. So the Presidential Emergency Board said workers should pay 15% of the cost of their monthly premiums. And workers were scared, basically, with healthcare costs, you never know, 15% of, you know, $5,000 a month is different from 15% of $1,000 a month. So they put a cap on it, basically saying through the life of the contract, it's not going to rise to more than $400 a month, which is still, you know, quite expensive for some of these workers who in living memory paid nothing for their healthcare premiums. So those were the two improvements that we think are in the deal. And the other key thing being that it changed the date, right? It said kicked back the first possible strike deadline. And we still don't actually know officially what the new deadline is. But essentially, they added some unpaid sick time. They capped what their healthcare contributions could be monthly. And they moved the timeline of the negotiations.
Jonah, what's your sense of what Marty Walsh and the Biden administration brought to these negotiations? I mean, why was their involvement needed to get us to this point?
You know, it's sort of hard to say for sure, to make assessments of the quality of the deal or sort of what their intervention was, because we haven't seen actual language. So, you know, on the one hand, if they said they won all 15 paid sick days, you would say, wow, it really looks like the leadership here, the political leadership here, stepped in and leaned on the carriers and said this had to go a certain way. But since we don't know exactly what the deal is, it's a little hard to say. I mean, the thing people should understand about these negotiations is that, again, because it's the railroad, it's covered under different labor law than every other private sector company that you hear negotiations in. And part of the process is that Congress is basically expected to step in at the end. So the last time there was a national rail strike and lockout was in 1992. And within something like 72 hours, Congress passed a bill that sent the parties back into arbitration. And that's part of this process where if you get to the very end of it, if it gets to the point of a work stoppage on either side, you're going to have Congress step in. So that means that political involvement is a lot more important. People are looking to the Democratic Party more closely than they are in a traditional strike. Like the John Deere strike last year, there was no real thought that there was going to be, you know, congressional intervention or direct political intervention besides sort of advocacy and press releases and things like that.
Sure.
In this case, they're basically dealing with Congress directly as part of contract negotiation.
What would the impact be of a major railroad strike of this kind to not just the transportation infrastructure, but to the economy as a whole?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And it's interesting because it's somewhat of a political question because you have both sides saying, oh, the stakes would be XYZ, it would be so high, it'd be such a disaster. The figures that were coming out were basically, it would cost the U.S. economy something like $2 billion a day. There was especially concerns about hazardous materials and emergency supplies. One of the things I saw was, for example, chlorine shipments being stopped to wastewater treatment plants. There's certain things, especially bulk materials that get moved along freight rail that can't reasonably be moved on any other vector. You can't just put them on trucks. You can't just put them on planes. So certainly hazardous materials, you know, essential supplies like that, liquid natural gas that's not sorted through pipelines goes on the rails. A lot of energy is transported by rail. And something like, I mean, the stats I've seen is something like 40% of, you know, freight movement in this country is by rail as opposed to truck or plane or boat. So you can imagine, you know, 40%, that includes all parts of the economy and not an insignificant portion of it. It's not really concentrated in one particular industry that uses the rails. It's everybody. I mean, people talk about John Deere. They send things out on freight rail. You have, obviously, fuel goes on freight rail, chemicals go on freight rail, food, grain. This was a big issue with, you had these agricultural companies that were really worried about what's going to happen if the rails shut down. We can't move the harvest, which starts in late September, for example, for corn. Mm. Then you have things sitting, which can spoil or freeze. And you're talking about a whole food supply chain crisis just because you can't move a train.
I'm talking with Jonah Furman, a writer with Labor Notes, about the deal that was announced last week to bring railroad workers back from the brink of a major strike. So let's talk about this deal. How do workers feel about it? They have to vote now on whether to accept it. Are unions poised to go forward and accept the deal, or is there trouble on the horizon?
You know, it's a great question, and it's really hard to guess, partly because, like I said, nobody's seen the deal. This is a frustration some workers have said. It's like they haven't even seen, you know, they've seen a few highlights based on press releases and things in they're reading in the news, but there hasn't been a sheet saying, here's what we agreed to, and in detail. And details matter, right? If you're talking about sick time, it matters. You know, the language of one of the press releases said, for certain medical procedures. Well, which procedures are covered? Who has to approve it? How many can you get? You know, is it one day a year or is it 15 days of unpaid leave a year? Just the devil is in the details here. And in trying to think about, are the unions going to accept this deal? The process goes to ratification in all of these unions. So you have 12 different unions where members have to vote on whether they want to accept this deal or go back to negotiations and threaten a possible strike or lockout again. So if you look at where people were at, where these rail workers were at before this, the tweaks made by the Walsh brokered deal, the Thursday deal, you had some unions doing internal polling that said 80% of members were ready to reject it. One of the unions rejected the deal on the Tuesday before the potential strike, with 63% voting to reject the deal and 90% voting in favor of a strike. So the question is, can you get from 80% rejection, 63% rejection, to 51% acceptance if you add a few unpaid sick days and cap healthcare costs at $400 a month? You know, my take is that workers are angry and were ready to take action and feel that that opportunity was sort of taken away at the last minute. So a lot of this to me echoes the John Deere strike, the dynamic I felt talking to members last year where they rejected multiple tentative agreements that were recommended by the company and the union. And because there's 12 unions involved and only one of them has to reject it to really threaten a national shutdown because of how integrated the rails are and these trades are, and because of unions respecting each other's picket lines, I think it's very possible that you see at least one of these 12 unions vote it down and get right up to a strike deadline just like we saw. It'll just kick the can down the road weeks or months.
So is there a scenario where just one of these unions, like say the engineers, decide that this deal is not for them and then all workers are going on strike?
Yeah, I mean, more or less. So the last national rail shutdown was in 1992, and it was basically the source of it was the machinists, one of the unions, on one of the rail lines on CSX, went on strike. And that essentially caused the entire rail system to shut down because of how integrated things are and because of the employers, you know, basically wanting to consolidate some of the conflict. So you could certainly see, you know, maybe not every union has the same leverage, but more or less, if one of these trades goes on strike, it's going to shut down a lot of the system. That's part of what we saw, you know, even with, for example, Amtrak shut down some long range lines last week because they use some of the freight lines rail track and maintenance crews. So these systems are just really integrated. So if you have one union strike, let alone other unions say we're not going to cross a picket line, which is also part of it, but just operationally, there's a lot of scenarios in which you have one of these trades go on strike and it functionally shuts down the whole system and has the same impact as if all of them rejected it resoundingly and walked out together.
Yeah, here in Seattle, we saw Amtrak route cancellations to Chicago and down to California in anticipation of the strike. I think that because it's been so long since there has been a major railroad strike, since the early 90s, as you mentioned, a lot of people were taken surprised, me included, by how integrated this is and how the private ownership of these rail lines means that a labor deal that falls apart with, you know, certain companies can just have a domino effect on the entire system. Jonah, thank you very much for explaining all this. Just final question for you. What's next? What are you watching for? What are the questions that you still have as we wait for the unions to vote on this tentative deal?
Well, the big one is what's in the deal. That's going to make all the difference for the members who actually vote on the thing. The second one is what's the timeline of the next quote unquote cooling off period? Basically, when is the first legal opportunity for either the rail carriers or the unions to initiate a work stoppage? Those are going to be the crucial details here about whether or not this thing is over. The other thing is, how are the operators going to respond? You know, when you talk about the Amtrak shutdowns we saw last week and the hazardous materials stopping being shipped, that was all a choice by the operators, essentially to put pressure on Congress saying, look how bad a rail shutdown would be. Don't you want to avoid that? And sort of provoking people into heightening raising the temperature on Congress to intervene, you know, which the carriers thought they would do in their favor. So if the carriers still want to use this sort of pseudo-legal bargaining tactic of we're going to slow things down, we're going to shut things down, we're going to put pressure on Congress so that the rail workers feel backed into a corner to accepting this thing, that's also going to be part of the negotiations. And I've already heard rail workers say, well, we're back to work and it's way worse than it was last week. They're being more, you know, there's more discipline, there's harder work schedules, there's more intensity on the rails this week, sort of because the employers certainly know this thing isn't over. And on the other side, the question is, will workers, you know, organize to vote no or organize to do more informational picketing or to do things that would signal to the carriers and to the public that this dispute is not settled?
Jonah Furman is a writer with Labor Notes and the author of Who Gets the Bird on Substack. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org or on your favorite podcast app.